women, especially when we lose that financial independence, your village is so important. And I couldn't do it without help. And it forced me, and it was a couple of week process. It didn't take long for me to say, I need to be back close to Devon, close to the people that won't let me fall far. But I go through this interesting process that you can read about in Dirty Love.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sound Bombing. I created this show for people who want to experience a radical, life-changing journey through the sounds of my diverse guests. I hope that each sound you hear on this show will strengthen your faith, encourage your dreams, and challenge you to awaken the greatness within you.
Drop the bomb!
Drop the bomb!
We're gonna drop the bomb!
Drop the bomb!
We're gonna drop the bomb!
Drop the bomb!
We come to drop the bomb!
Drop the bomb!
This is a journey into sound. A journey which along the way will bring to you new color, new dimension, new values, and a new experience.
Ladies and gentlemen, the star of the show,
Lamar Darnell Shields.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whatever the time of the day it is, you are here with me and I'm your host, Dr. Lamar Darnell Shields, the creator of Sound Bombing. And my goal with this show, as always, is to introduce you to people with ideas that will help you unlock your full potential. Now, we are in November, and I know that because I know that we're in November, but October was just here, and October was Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Now, while domestic violence may seem like an obvious issue, it really isn't. People's understanding of what constitutes domestic varies, which can lead to many serious issues being overlooked. And so this was recognized in 1987. It was a federally designated by Congress in 1989, Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And then we also know that COVID has heightened so many other things. And the COVID pandemic has had a devastating effect, not only on us financially, emotionally, and spiritually, but it had an effect on us dealing with domestic violence. We know that worldwide, including the United States, domestic violence rates and the rates of reporting and seeking emergency shelter have skyrocketed. Hey, well, my next guest is going to talk about some of the challenges that she had to overcome. She has an amazing journey and a story, which she shares in her book, Dirty Love. She is working to build a community for women to better their relationships and feel supported while talking about serious issues that are still very prominent in our society. She hopes her work will inspire other women and men to seek their own truths and live a more authentic life. Who am I talking about? I am talking about Kimberly Blackburn. Kimberly, welcome to Sound Bombing. Let our listeners know how you are doing, because we like to do a wellness check. And then go ahead, shout out, let our listeners know where you're calling in from.
Sure. Thank you, Dr. Shields. That was an amazing introduction. I'm very honored to be here with you. And I am actually coming from sunny Scottsdale. It's a beautiful time of year right now. Maybe 70 degrees, and we don't get very many cloudy days. So from now until about May, it's just such an amazing place to be. We spend a lot of time outside.
I'm taking a couple of deep breaths because two of my favorite states has nothing to do with politics either.
Right.
Colorado and Arizona. Kimberly, I was just there in August. We could have done real-time, face-to-face downtown Scottsdale, around the water, at the mall. I love Scottsdale. I was just there in August, went hiking in Sedona, flew in.
Beautiful,
you know, I had a great time. I love it. But Kimberly, what's so interesting is out of majority of the people that I met in Arizona, all are from Chicago. I'm like, what's going on in Chicago? Well, first of all, probably the cold weather, blizzard, maybe crime, but still one of my favorite cities where I'm from. But I met at least 10 people, no lie. All of them were from Chicago, old, new, different races, cultures, and genders. So it's something about that place, you know, that I love draws me in. It's a great place of healing, great weather. Now, I've not been there in the summertime. Now, I heard the devil lives there. Nope, you know, not the real devil, but you know what I'm talking about. Oh, yes, I heard I that do. The heat in Arizona, and I work in Palm Springs quite a bit, is unbearable. What is it?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm actually a Minnesota girl, and I did live in Chicago for a period of time. So I am a Midwest girl in my heart. I am a cold weather girl. I grew up a competitive downhill skier. So Arizona was a bit of a transition for me. You know, you do not have your seasons, but there is something about the sunshine and just the beautiful opportunities here, from hiking, as you mentioned, to you're truly 2 hours away from skiing. You know, you're 5 hours away from the coast in California. It is a soulful place, but I think a lot of that has to do with the sunshine and just the beauty of the climate. The summer, yes, is intense. You need a swimming pool for sure.
Let me tell you, it was hot in August. I'm a hiker. I do everything outdoor. I just love it. And so I had a great time there. Interesting. I'm serious. If we would have met before then, I would have definitely brought my equipment. You know, I can travel with equipment now. Yes. We could have sat on one of those hot rocks.
We could do that again.
Cool side. No, I'm going to hold you to that because I will be back there again. And we have Midwest roots. You're from Minnesota.
I am.
I'm from Chicago. All right. Are you a Prince fan?
Oh, yes.
All right. Because you cannot be.
I was born and raised in Eden Prairie. So okay. Miles away from where Prince lived. So, yes.
You can't be from Minnesota and not be a Prince fan. I mean, I have tons of Prince stories. I won't share them on this show. But let's get down to, I am excited and honored that you did decide to hang out with me. Now, we know that this is a serious topic that we are going to be discussing. And so I read the information that was sent to me from our producers and my engineers, and got a chance to go through the book and read some of the book. But before we jump into the book, you know, in my introduction, I talked about all the challenges that COVID has just manifested everywhere. Now, there's some outside of people dying, all these other things. There have been some great things. Businesses started, relationships have gotten better. People are teaching themselves how to sew, draw, paint, starting new businesses. But in my introduction, I talked about the rate of domestic violence just increasing, during this pandemic. You know, before we get into your story, why do you think that that's so?
You know, it is interesting because I have done a lot of reading on that subject, and I do know that shelters for domestic abuse victims are often turning away, and I think during COVID, especially, it was such a concentrated period where we were so isolated. Our jobs started to look different. We spent a lot of time at home. It was challenging with the children being out of school and having to navigate that balance with work and taking care of children and relationships. So I think with tensions being high, naturally, the more time you spend in that environment leaves women that are already susceptible in unhealthy relationships to, you know, a more extreme situation where, maybe an unhealthy relationship evolves into something that puts a woman's life at risk. And that's, I think, what we really saw during the time of COVID. I know financial strain contributes to that, and many, many factors at play. And as a broad community, we just saw how much it impacted our stress, you know, aside from our relationships and our children, just trying to find that sense of normalcy. So I think it makes sense.
Well, in your book, you talk about struggles, you talk about pain, you also talk about triumphs and challenges. Mm-hmm. I know as a writer, writing a first novel is writing your first book is always a big step. So what inspired you to write this book? And then, you know, to finally share your story after 20 years of going through what you've gone through.
Sure. You know, and it speaks to an important point, which I'll start with, is that It has been 10 years of holding this story close to me before I felt ready to share. And perhaps it's a, you know, it was my time just going through that trauma. I needed that, those number of years of healing to be really ready to be in my element to share the story. Or it was something or combination of things that still in our society, there is that public perception, that shaming that happens when women come forward with their stories. And it's hard to imagine, but I actually experienced it myself.
So before you get into the story, talk to my listeners about preparing for to share the story. Like, what was the prep work? Because I do want them to know the story, but you're talking about trauma. But I want to talk about how do you mentally, physically, spiritually prepare yourself to sit down. And I love stories. I just watched this great Netflix series called From Scratch. Great love story. Unfortunately, I'm not going to tell what happened to one of the main characters. But when I'm looking at this, I was so emotionally connected to each character, the husband, the wife, the children. They were in Italy, you know, what happened, death and birth and things of that nature. But I can only imagine what it's like to prepare to sit down and put this stuff on paper. Talk about the preparation and then let's jump into the inspiration to the story.
Absolutely. So probably about 2 years before I actually dove into writing the story, I, despite having this beautiful life, a beautiful family, I started to feel very unhappy, very restless in my life. And a few months before I started writing, I was on an airplane sitting next to a woman. And for whatever reason, I decided to share the very just details I haven't shared, even with my own husband, about what had happened to me. And a few days later, we exchanged information and she was very supportive and kind of walked away thinking, gosh, this is still, these memories are still so close to me. And a few days later, I had an email from her and she was actually the CEO of a major publishing house. And she said, Kimberly, I think this is your time to share this story. And so literally this opportunity was dropped in my lap. And that motivation, you know, I have never been a person that really believes in the reason for things. I always felt that there was a combination of hard work and the right opportunity and a little bit of luck and aligning yourself with the right people and things come your way. But this opened my eyes to, gosh, you know, there is a purpose in my struggle. You know, there is a power in that. And that evolved into this 11-month writing process. And as far as giving myself permission, I will say I hadn't prior to now done a lot of reading on trauma and what it truly does to your body emotionally, physically. And when I started writing, it took many weeks to actually give myself permission to go there. And it was an interesting process because I went from changing my location, jumping from coffee shop to a bar to a park, trying to find the safe place where I could visit that time. You know, early on, it even took, and I'm not a big drinker, but it took alcohol to free my mind at times. And it was finally, and it didn't take long, but a few weeks later, it just started to come. And it was then quite easy to release it all. Don't get me wrong, there were some very intense moments of feeling like, you know, is this going to help me? Like this makes me revisiting this time is almost worse than experiencing it at the time because of the perspective and the clarity I have today. So it's quite a scary process.
So it is almost re-traumatizing yourself when you are sharing a story, when you're watching a film. I'm going to give you an example and I appreciate what you shared. I've watched this film and I love it. I'm telling everybody to check it out. It's called From Scratch. And I was so caught up in this movie. And I said to my partner, who has a husband who's gravely ill, and I thought that these stories were mirrored. Like, you know, she's from America, her husband is from another place. In the film, it's the same thing. And then as I start watching the film, I noticed that something happens to the husband. I'm not going to give the story away. So I called my friend who's a teacher at a film school. And she said, you need to retract that message that you sent to your partner to watch this film, because she is going to be traumatized if what happens to this one of the characters in the film happens to her husband. And I had to send her the message. Hey, remember that film I told you to check out? I don't really think you should watch that film. And so as someone listening, when you are writing these stories, when you're sharing even on stages and when you're sharing them right here, there is this re-traumatization that you're going back. I can even hear it in your voice, the shakiness in your mm-hmm. voice that says that there's still some connection to it. And that's the human connection that we have as people. I can feel what you're feeling, even though I've not been an abuser or have not been abused, but because of we are human people first, that then I can feel that sort of that connection. So I can only imagine writing this story. When I wrote my story, what I learned in the midst of chaos, the making of an Ubuntu teacher, there were some traumatic things, but nothing as grave as what you're sharing. Now, do you have a writing background? And if not, how did you begin to write this book? I mean, it was good having a writing coach. And I'm sitting here now, you know, the people that listen to this, the show, they're going to be like, maybe I'm sitting right next to the next owner of this place or next CEO of this. Because how, and I don't believe in coincidence, the fact that you're sitting next to this woman who then works for a major publishing house.
Yes.
Talk to me about your writing process. Are you a writer? Was this your very first time writing something this extensive? If not, how did you also prepare for that?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I was always a good student and I was always a very good creative writer. I'm the type of person that if you receive a thank you note from me, it's a long, very emotional note.
Oh, so you're one of those long. So your text messages are probably real long, right?
They used to be. Now I'm a little more.
So my female friends, like, I'll send him a long message and he'll say, okay. I'm like, I don't really need that many words. And I understand the power of words.
Yeah.
So you were a great student. You were a creative writer.
Go ahead. A very emotional writer. I think that has always been a skill that I've had. And it was important to me, if I was going to write the story, that you really felt my emotion, what I was thinking at the time. So I really had to give myself permission to try to share with the reader, like, how could I possibly make this right in my mind at the time? Because that's the perspective I think that is so challenging for people to understand, that it's not black or white. You know, if you, like, we know what abuse looks like. And when you read the story, you see it start with an element of a lack of control in the relationship, and how that evolved into emotional abuse and verbal abuse. And at the end, you know, the physical abuse became really intense. So for most people, you know, the first question I get is, well, when that happens, you must know it's wrong. But it's this process that you start over this almost 10-year period where you build up these defense mechanisms. And it's quite amazing how we adapt and almost enter the survival mode where your hope in this person, your hope for the life that you imagined having together, just makes you put up this wall to protect this person despite this horrible mistreatment. So in the writing process, I knew I had to give everything I had to be able to shed light on how complicated of an issue this is.
So let's talk about the story.
Yeah.
Share with my listeners what was happening, how you and your husband connected, what was going on in the process, and then how you separated, what that was like.
Yes. Well, so to give a little bit of background, I had a beautiful childhood. I was a very accomplished horse rider, equestrian. I had a very supportive family, two amazing siblings. And I mentioned before, I was a competitive downhill skier, lots of options in life, the world at my fingertips at, you know, 20 years old. And in college, my mom was diagnosed with cancer. And it turned my kind of picture perfect life upside down. And my dad really struggled with the diagnosis. And it forced myself and my two siblings to grow up very quickly. And my college life did not look like most college students' lives. You know, I often was driving home from, I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I was driving from Madison to Minneapolis to help support in the care of my mother. So I think those 4 years set me up in many ways for this relationship. And I had moved to Chicago after graduating from University of Wisconsin and worked in technology. And this was a workplace romance, but it was also with a man that was my superior, actually a couple layers above me. And while he was not that much older than me, he just had so much more experience than I did. And I found myself, you know, at the time, this wasn't something we talked as much as we do now. I found myself receiving opportunities in the workplace for travel, being put on assignments that I was incredibly underqualified for as a result of my relationship with him. And it slowly unfolded. And, you know, he was in a marriage. And for a period of time, I believe that he was being unfaithful in his marriage with me and our relations. But I was so young at 22 that in many ways I was blind to this very unhealthy dynamic that we talk about a lot today. And in other ways, I wanted that easy button. My life had been quite hard for a number of years because of my mother's illness and her passing. So he kind of hit that easy button for me. I was on this fast track for an amazing career in technology, and it was attractive to me. So that unfolded in a way that we hear often about relationships. I became less focused on my career. I became more focused on a life with him. And it slowly progressed. We ended up getting married. That dynamic where I was unfocused on myself and focused on him was very prevalent. We moved from Chicago up to Minneapolis for him to take a job, and I was unemployed. I was focused on things like shopping and working out and kind of this life that didn't really fulfill me. But at the time, it felt okay. It was easy. And his success, you know, and backing up a little bit to talk about Jeremy, he was a very, very intelligent man, a very intelligent software developer. His success, it's unfortunate it ended the way it did because he was a very hard worker. And so by the time, you know, I was in my mid to late 20s, he was a very top executive and then moving to start his own company. And once he did that, it just propelled our lifestyle. And we went, you know, in my mid 20s, I was living in a million-dollar house, and we were traveling the country, and it was this amazing life. But nowhere in this life was my plan and what was important to me. And the natural progression came, well, we should have a family. And I kind of sold myself the idea of, well, what an amazing opportunity. I get to be home raising the children, supporting my husband, who is developing this amazing software. And, you know, as the abuse and control, I would say as a lifestyle heightened, so did the level of abuse and control. And that's where it gets complicated, because I think there were a number of forces at play. I believe Jeremy was diagnosed as bipolar. He had, manic depressive tendencies where you ride the waves. It was either, you know, working through the night or, sleeping all day or over exercising or no exercise at all. There was never this in between. And that was very much our lifestyle. It was very, very extreme. But when you love somebody and you see, you have that hope and you catch those glimpses of who you think they are, you normalize that behavior. And to fast track his company just before, well, and it's tricky because a lot of things were happening that I wasn't aware of. At some point, he raised a large sum of venture capital money and started misappropriating those funds. And at that point, we had moved from Minneapolis. We had abandoned our plans to raise a family in Minnesota. And we had moved to Malibu. And we were in this beautiful $6 million home overlooking the ocean. And I was there just a month before I caught wind of an FBI investigation that his company, Canopy Financial, was under investigation for misappropriating not only venture capital money, but also the accounts of consumers that were using their custodial services to save money for their healthcare expenses. And that was so obviously gut-wrenching and took me by such surprise that this lifestyle we were living, which by then included, you know, the highest priced exotic cars and travel exclusively on private, NetJets type services. And it was this life that everybody envied. And so catching wind of this, I was like, gosh, this can't be happening. And within weeks of learning that and processing what it meant and understanding that this life had to change for me. And we had a 2-year-old son together. I then learned that he was leading a double life to such an extreme level. It was with a woman that actually very much looked like me. She had a dog, just like our dog. And they lived a mile away from our house.
So he had another family.
Another family.
Malibu, which is Malibu is a beautiful place.
It is.
And the other person mirrored your life, looked like you, had a dog. Did she have a child?
They did end up having a child together through this. And but for a period of time towards the end of our relationship. Where I assumed he was traveling solely for his company, for the growth of his company. And there was talks of actually another company acquiring them, that he was really spending time in this other relationship, in this other life. And this is during a period where I, you know, at first was pregnant and then had a young infant. And I was the sole caretaker. My life was very, very isolated. And the hard part about that is that I believed so much in what he was doing, you know, growing this business, together we were making the sacrifices. And that's what the American dream, right? That you work really hard, you dig in, and then you work for this life that you want to live.
So did you believe the lie so much that you didn't want to go back to your traditional lifestyle, you know, going back to Wisconsin, going back to Minnesota, dealing with the situation with your mom, dealing with your dad. Yeah. Did you just want to believe that this was the truth, or you just was like, you know, I'm just going to go along with the ride until the wheels fall off?
Sure. Well, that's interesting because of the FBI investigation, and we had been estranged for a period of time before that came to light. You know, him managing two relationships, as you can imagine, it was very complicated. So
this is a busy guy. You're managing $1 million company. You're living in $1 million home.
Yes.
You're managing two. And first two of all, women. One woman is enough. I mean, just one woman, but right. Two women with is right. Quite a bit to handle.
Yes.
Was there a moment where you brought in other people who then started to ask questions, or were encouraging you, saying, hey, Kim, why don't you look into this? Why don't you look into that? Did you not take heed to some of the things that they were saying? Or you just want to continue to live this lifestyle and say, I don't want to find out what the truth is? Because, you know, when you look for something, you find it.
Sure.
And quite often, many of us don't want to look for those things. We want to continue with the lifestyle that we have. Were you sort of caught up in that conundrum of I just want to be right here and not worry about what could happen?
It's a very, very important question, because I think in our society, the tricky part for me is that because I had this life that most people envied, even with the red flags, people didn't ask me the hard questions.
So did you ask yourself the hard questions? So people didn't ask you the questions, but did you then start to ask yourself some questions about sort of where you were, or where you were? And if so, what question, if you did, then what are some of the questions you start to ask yourself?
Yeah. So I think that the moment that I had a child, Cal, who I talk about in the book, and the stress of, you know, as having children, those first months having a baby is an incredibly stressful time. And I had protected Jeremy and our lifestyle so much to the extent that I wasn't willing to share with other people how much he was absent from our life. So I was at home taking care of this young child. And when people would try to reach in to help, I kept them at arm's length. Because as you said, I was covering for this life. It was like, gosh, if we can just get this company sold, Jeremy's going to come back to this family and we're going to have this beautiful life.
Well, isn't that what abusers do? They isolate the one that they're abusing. So isolation can mean various things. It could be not giving out your address, telephone numbers. Isolation can be moving. I mean, Malibu is a long way from Wisconsin, Chicago, and Minnesota. Isolation can mean we're not inviting people over so they won't find out what's going on. Was there a moment where you felt like you were isolated? Because again, Malibu, big house kid, did you have support? Was there a moment that you felt that way?
So, and that too is an important, in abusive situations, it's a gradual process that happens. It starts, you know, long before we had a child together and long before we lived the Malibu lifestyle, simply, you know, going out to dinner with friends and having uncomfortable topics brought up that made me not want to socialize with him and other people. Or, you know, I recall in the book a time where we were house shopping and Jeremy had selected the realtor that would be helping us through this process. And he was a young, attractive man. And I spent a day with him looking for houses, as you do. And at the end of the day, I was accused of being unfaithful. And it was almost to the extent that he set me up in situations to feel so uncomfortable, to question myself, that I began to avoid that altogether. And with my family, who I know, especially my brother, who is older than me, was picking up on things. And it was easier for him to not pick up his phone calls. You know, it was easier to isolate than to have to answer those hard questions. Because in my mind, I was like, he'll see. We're going to be okay. And that was very tricky. And I recall in the story in Malibu, when things finally, the truth finally came out and the story started to break the news and I learned of the double life, and I drove from Malibu up to San Francisco and to just tell my brother everything I knew. And in so many ways, it had set me free to finally receive that love and support that I needed so much, and that I had been guarded against for so long, trying to protect this life. And as far as the lifestyle, I knew it's interesting. Money and material things at times is like a drug. So if you're not, and it works that way for all of us, right? We're at times motivated by beautiful things, whether it's travel or, you know, tickets to sporting events or a new purse. And you know, that's a little bit of that human nature. So I found that those times that I was so isolated, you know, filling my soul, you know, for a short window of time, it worked. It kind of bought that time that I needed. As you're to your point.
Go ahead.
When Callan was born as an infant, the physical abuse, there were moments where.
Before you go back to, we're going to come back because we're going to have to chop this up because we missed something. Sure. But I want to go back. You talked about this need. You talked about how material items almost became like a drug. It was an escape from the reality of what was going on. What do you feel like you were in need of? We know it wasn't the material items because they didn't bring you the joy. They didn't bring you the feelings of euphoria for a long time. It sort of wore off after a while. What did Kim need that she was not getting in the relationship and or maybe prior to the relationship?
Sure. I think feeling like I was enough. Feeling like while I didn't have my own career path and in many ways my own identity that filled my soul, I so much of it was dependent on my relationship, my marriage, and what Jeremy gave back to me. So I was yearning for that intimacy, that connection, and his fast track lifestyle, and obviously the infidelity, and he was not there for me. And since I had protected this lifestyle and him, I didn't have a lot of other people there for me. So there was a lot of moments alone, questioning, wondering. And it's easy to fill that void with, you know, I worked out excessively. I got back into horses, which has always been a passion of mine. And, you know, just trying to find center in my life.
You know, it's interesting. I watched this show called American Greed. And I don't know if this made it to that. It may make it. And as I read your bio and what was sent to me, I thought about the show American Greed. It comes on CNBC. And you hear these stories, you hear about them. And you always wonder what happened to the people, not the people who did the crime, because we know where they go.
Sure.
But you always wonder what happened to the people who were victims, the victims who either lost money, the victims who either lost themselves in the crime, the victims who some of them, you know, disappeared, committed suicide, moved on. Quite often we don't ever get a chance. And I'm so glad and I'm applauding you for sharing the story. We don't often hear or get a chance to hear the stories of the victim in this process from you, your children, your family members, because all of the people that's in your network are all a victim. They were a part of the game. While you felt like you were protecting him, because I've heard you say that before, were you really protecting him or were you really more so hiding what was going on? And if you feel like you were protecting him, then why didn't you protect yourself or protect your son from what was actually happening?
Absolutely. That self-betrayal that we talk about, not valuing yourself, choosing someone else before you choose yourself, it's important. And, you know, I think that there's probably many reasons why I lost myself in that relationship. I think the pressure in your 20s that we still feel today, many people, like, you know, you have to graduate, you have to find your dream job, you have to find your soulmate and have children and buy a beautiful house. You have to check all these boxes, right? We place such a high value on that for some reason, when we get into a relationship and if it doesn't work, it's considered a failure rather than a success of clearly defining what you need. And if it's not that person, setting that boundary for yourself, that's what I missed. I didn't want to be a failure. I felt like I had it all at such a young age. And it was an accomplishment after the tragedy of losing my mom and in many ways losing my dad. And I didn't want to let that go. I had this facade of a life that again, everybody envied. But back to your point about protecting myself and my son, I think my mentality shifted when my son was a month or 2 months old, where there was moments where I was holding him. And I talk about this in Dirty Love, where I had to debate, do I continue to hold him because I feel like Jeremy is going to grab me and push me down the stairs? So I had to make a choice. Do I put him down quickly and increase the chance that that would actually happen? Or do I hold Callan, hoping that that steers Jeremy a different direction?
And what was the outcome?
And I put Callan down, of course. It was those moments that shift was, I need to get out. I need help. I just don't know how.
So let's talk about how you got out and who did you turn to for help?
So it's interesting. I actually, there were a few times, and I talk about her in the book. I had a best friend, Devin. And in many ways, we became a bit estranged because she started asking questions. And
Devin was a nosy girlfriend, huh?
Yes, she was.
I like that. Devin was a nosy neighbor before there was the community watch. We need those people quite often in our lives. Devin was getting a little nosy, like, Devin.
And unemotional. Like, she's very action oriented. You know, she was in law school at the time, so there were times that I picked up the phone to call her. And if she picked up, I was going to tell her. And for whatever reason, it didn't happen. There were also times where.
So why did it happen? Let's stop right. Cause I want people to really understand the mindset of someone who is going through a level of abuse. Now, they may not be living in Malibu or big homes, but it's something that sort of kept them there. In that moment when you got Devin on the phone, hey girl, what's going on? What's new? What's on sale? How's the baby doing? Why did you not say
say it out loud to someone, you lose control. So when you say it out loud, it means, okay, something has to happen.
So when you say you lose control, were you really ever in control?
No, and that's the interesting.
But in your mind, you feel like that you're losing control, but you weren't really controlling what was happening to you.
Absolutely. And I think, but as soon as I knew, I shared the story that I had to make change. And it wasn't clear to me that I needed to make change, as crazy as that sounds. But as you're that time together in those defense mechanisms and that survival mode, you hang on to that hope that, gosh, if something shifts, this software company gets sold, you know, Jeremy retires, like our life could be good again. We get therapy together. And I think that is a very, very common defense mechanism that a lot of women have. You fight for that person, especially when your self-confidence has taken such a toll. So I do believe that's a common theme. Now, my personality, I fight for people. I'm a very selfless person. I'm a people pleasing person. So in my mind, it wasn't something we couldn't work through, despite how much it was hurting me. So what really made it stop is external forces that I could not control. And that was the combination of the FBI investigation, the company crumbling, crashing down, and then learning of the double life. That was the first time I kind of looked up. I remember having this conversation with my brother and said, okay, someone is telling me to get out, that it is time. And on top of that, having a child, I needed to put his best interests first. And being associated with Jeremy, and I knew very little about his wrongdoings with the company, but certainly supporting him left me vulnerable. And I had no knowledge or responsibility for his legal misconduct. So it was important to me to create that separation.
Now talk to me about the FBI. Like, you know, in the movies, there's a certain way. So do they come knocking on your door with the badge FBI? Or is it something you got a letter in the mail? You saw something.
Yeah.
How did the FBI approach you or your ex-husband?
Yeah. So this is challenging to talk about, but I actually got an email from my brother. And my brother is, at the time was in venture capital and technology in Silicon Valley. So
you just around a whole bunch of rich folks, man, right. What's going on? The next book better not be about your brother.
And in the email, it said, Kimberly, I'm here for you. We will get through this together.
Was from your brother?
That was from my brother. And then there was a link, and the link was a press release about Canopy Financial being under investigation.
And that's I like Devin and your brother. I don't even know them, but the fact that he opened up by saying, we're here for you. No judgment. Boom. Let's open this thing up.
And that's keep in mind, my brother at the time had no idea, what I was experiencing behind closed doors. He, knew Jeremy to have a personality that was, I call it unique, but he was very narcissistic. So he saw that side of Jeremy that made him uncomfortable, but he had no idea that I was experiencing such extreme abuse behind closed doors.
I'll go ahead and finish. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, when he first reached out to me, it was, you know, you have to make some significant life changes here and distance yourself. You know, you have a child to think about. So it was only later then, once the infidelities came out and the rest of the story, that I was really able to open up to my family about what had happened. To some extent, and I think that's an important point, it's only now with releasing the book that they really know what I endured, the physical and the emotional abuse.
So talk to me about the exit strategy. How did you and the baby get out of there? What was that process like?
So you brought up an important point. You said, you know, was there a period of time where you didn't want to leave the lifestyle? There was. We lived in this home, you know, in Malibu. California is expensive anyways, but it's a $6 million home overlooking the ocean. You know, property taxes are a lot. The water bill alone is more than most people's rent or mortgage. The list, I mean, more money, more problems, more money, different problems. I mean, I was simply unable to stay in that house, but I knew because of the FBI investigation that the house was frozen as an asset.
Had he moved out of the house?
So charged, he was, charged. His Canopy Financial was based in Chicago. So he went back to Chicago. And
to face the charges.
To face the charges.
So you were in this house by yourself.
I'm in this house by myself with Callan, who is about a year and a half.
And you're trying to decide what your next move is, and the water
trying to
bill
decide what my next
probably
move
more
is.
Expensive than my mortgage.
Absolutely.
Wait, why is the water bill so high? You can't be taking that many showers. The baby is not drinking that much water.
Right. Well, the California, they're a drought. You have to have your perfect vegetation and your avocado trees and your citrus trees. You know, it's looking back at it now, it's ridiculous. It's embarrassing, right? But when you're in the moment, this is your life, and this is such a major accomplishment. So I had hired an attorney in Chicago, a criminal attorney, to help me navigate what Jeremy's life was going to look like and what my exposure was. And fortunately, there was a lot of emails and communications that kept me very distant from Jeremy. But all of my credit cards, all of my bank accounts, everything were frozen with the exception of one. So with one bank account, I had to navigate this situation. I had to buy enough time in this house and try to cover enough expenses to make it livable, and also hire legal representation. And in situations like this, lawyers want big retainers. So, you know, I might have had 50 years of law experience on my side, but I was, you know, might not have had the money to pay for diapers for my young son. So the reality is, And I was able to buy 3 to 4 months in Malibu, but I realized quickly that I needed, safety was an issue. And because Canopy Financial had been in the news, you know, I was concerned. There was a point that I actually hired private security. But I start this process of saying, you know, to Devin, I'm going to stay in California. Like, I think I could be happy here. Cal and I will have a small house, maybe down in Santa Monica. Like, I had this romantic idea of what starting life would be, but I was entitled. I had lived this life for long enough. And that was so far from my reality.
Devin said, girl, you need to come on back home. Stop playing. Get on these horses, ride around, make some money.
I did. And the horses I was selling to pay for my legal.
And for those that don't know, I love horseback riding. I do not own a horse. Horses are super expensive.
They are expensive, especially at the level that I was competing. So finally, I was like, okay, I don't have anybody in Southern California. I can't afford to live here. You know, as women, especially when we lose that financial independence, your village is so important. And I couldn't do it without help. And it forced me, and it was a couple of week process. It didn't take long for me to say, I need to be back close to Devin, close to the people that won't let me fall far. But I go through this interesting process that you can read about in Dirty Love. We had a house still in Minnesota, and it was also under an asset freeze. So I could have went back to this house and lived mortgage-free for a period of time until it was, you know, released from the asset freeze and then foreclosed on. But I couldn't do that emotionally. To me, I felt like a failure. I didn't want to revisit that time. So I rented a house in Minneapolis, which was a bad decision because I actually needed to preserve that money. And as it turned out, that house was in foreclosure and I had only weeks there. And that finally brought me to the decision to move back to my home. And I was able to stay in that home for a period, about 7 months, and really redefine my life as a single mom and find those moments that I had missed. You know, it's interesting when you let go of all that's not real in your life, all that's healthy, you release that. I felt this new purpose, even though I had so many things looming. I had the FBI wanting to interview me. I had the constant threat of my bank account being taken away. I was trying to figure out, well, I'm going to go to law school, but how do I make that work when I have a child? And how do I cover the expense of law school and childcare? All of these really real issues that keep women stuck in their relationships. So once I ended up back in Minnesota, I was able to stay in that home, but then that time ended and I turned to Devin and I wasn't sure. Honestly, it was a breaking point for me, what I was going to do. And I ended up moving into her home above her garage. And so as I talk to women, I understand while I live this lifestyle that not very many people can relate to, I actually lost it all and found myself above a garage. But in losing it all, I gained my life back and my spirit back and this intention for life that was really was a powerful shift for me. And I think I do a good job in the story of sharing that shift and that power, but how difficult it was. And those are realities that so many women are faced with in choosing to leave an unhealthy relationship.
Wow. Well, we are going to leave it right there. I mean, such a great story. I know everybody wants to know what happened to your ex. What was the outcome with the company?
Yes. So Jeremy was charged for his criminal wrongdoings and misappropriating funds. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison. And you'll read about it in the book. He never went to prison. The day before reporting to prison, he took his own life. And Callan was, 3 or 4 years old at the time. Callan has no memory, really, of Jeremy. And in many ways, that I do, and I know. Actually, I didn't question it. In the book, Jeremy had wrote me a letter that I received after he passed away. And it's an interesting letter because even in reading it, you want to believe him. You know, he tries to fall on his sword. But I think when you read the letter, you'll realize it's more of the same of that kind of manipulation that he was so good at. And it's a powerful moment. And I debated about putting that in the book, but it was important. It's an important part of the story. So unlike a lot of women that are suffering in abusive situations and are able to create a new life, but perhaps have to share children, I didn't have to do that. I didn't have to co-parent. I didn't have to navigate having Callan's father in prison and what my obligation was, if anything. So I was very fortunate that way.
So how is Kim doing today? And what is Kim doing to take care of herself?
Yes, gosh. So 11 months of writing, that is an intense process. And I think when I finished the last chapter, I was like, goodness, what did I just do? Was this a good idea? And in finishing that chapter, it gave me an opportunity to kind of reflect on what am I doing in my life that is holding me back? Because I do feel like the last 10 years, just processing that, I felt in many ways I could just replace the memories, right? It just works like that. I could find this new life and find the security, the safety, the comfort that I needed, and it would be okay. What doesn't quite, it's not quite that simple. I needed to give myself permission to release this story, which I did. And I knew that if I helped one person, it would be worth it. And I have helped way more than one person. So it's by far exceeded my expectations. So in this, now that the book has been out a few months, I think really dialing into what brings me joy, my horses. I have two Arabian horses in Texas, and I actually just returned from competing at our U.S. Nationals, which is in Oklahoma. And I ended up winning a national championship on a horse that was supposed to be retired.
Congratulations.
And he's had soundness problems, and for whatever reason, it all came together in a beautiful moment, and that was just in October. So that was a very amazing time, especially after going through writing the story. But aside from that, I have two boys, 4 and 14, and I love to work out. You know, Scottsdale, the hiking, you know, I spend a lot of time outside. Nutrition is really important to me. I really take care of myself. And, you know, and I really think the healing now comes with opportunities like this, where, you know, I can share this and I'm not hiding behind a screen typing. I'm actually, you hear the emotion in my voice and you hear how passionate I am about these issues.
What message do you have for women who feel stuck? For women who don't have a Devin, who don't have a brother, or feel like they don't have a Devin or don't have a brother like yours to dump this stuff on, to engage them on how to get out. What message do you have for those women and men? Because men also are dealing with this as well.
Absolutely. And in the last chapter of the book, it's a chapter to Callan. And I talk very much about on a broad perspective, like what our relationships mean to us. Like when you start to not feel authentic in your relationship, like what do you do? And my advice to him was to take a step back and turn to somebody you trust for clarity. And feel comfortable saying, hey, this is happening in my life. Like, how do you, you know, how do you see this? Or this is what I'm feeling. And it's a hard step for women, but taking that first step and finding that one person that they can confide in. And maybe it's that one person that you know will listen without judgment, is such an important step. And it's even, you know, it is tricky because often that pressure when you do share with someone, you feel that pressure to make change. And a lot of women aren't ready to make change. You know, a lot of women don't want to give up that lifestyle because the idea of starting over seems insurmountable. So it's not easy by any means. But what I wish, I would have trusted my gut and I would have reached out to Devin long before, the FBI investigation and other things came to light that really forced my decision. So that would be my recommendation. I feel so passionate about it. Even on my website, I put a form and, you know, I put the hotline number for domestic violence.
Well, let's go back. All right, let's go back. We're going to come back to that. We're going to be chopping this whole thing up. Before I ask my last question, how can my listeners get in contact with you?
Well, if you can find me and follow my journey on Instagram, and that is KJ_Blackburn. And in the coming weeks, you'll start to see a website and you'll start to see what I'm doing, where to find me, where I'm speaking. And there is a contact form there. And I love hearing from women who are inspired by my story. I love, just the other day, I had a woman reach out and say that she shared her miscarriage story on social media in part because of hearing my story and that vulnerability, and that she's so happy that she did because she doesn't feel so alone, that she's heard so many stories from other women having gone through the same thing.
Well, today you really inspired tons of women. And also, you've also lighted a fire under some men as well, who not only may be a recipient or the receivers of abuse as well, because men are also going through this. But I know your message is for women, and I really appreciate your transparency, your courage. Being courageous says a lot about sort of who you are, and this story needs to be heard. I thank you for sharing it with my listeners here on Sound Bombing. But before you leave, Kimberly, you have to participate in the super bomb questions. And these questions are rapid fire questions. So I'm going to ask them as quickly as possible, and I need you to respond as quickly as possible. Are you ready, Kimberly?
I'm ready.
Here we go. What's your favorite word?
Peace.
Right. What's your superpower?
Oh, kindness.
What's your spirit animal?
It has to be a horse.
What moves you to tears of joy?
Music.
What moves you to tears of sorrow? What advice would you give your younger self?
To trust my gut.
If you were in the Mrs. America talent competition, what would your talent be?
I'd like to say dancing.
What's your favorite sound?
That's an easy one. My 4-year-old son's laugh.
Kimberly Blackburn, the author of Dirty Love. I wish you much success. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for sharing all your information. So thanks for hanging out with me today in the bomb shelter.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here with you today, Dr. Shields. And thank you for all that you're doing in the community and lifting so many people.
Thank you. And I cannot do this without that amazing music by Supremacy, who provides that great music. And all of you for listening, listen, stop being stingy. Share me with all of your friends. If you like anything that you heard Kimberly say, and I'm sure you did, make sure you subscribe. Go and tell everybody about us. We're on every platform. Leave a comment and stop being stingy and share me with all of your people. If you want to know more about me, go to drdrlds.com. And as always, believe that something wonderful is about to happen, and that some people miss the message because they're too busy looking for the mess, but not you. Thank you for tuning in to Sound Bombing. Peace.